Delighted to be with you and sitting in for George Norrie. You know, for all of the Grateful Dead's freewheeling chaos in their music and often in their lives, they were really early adopters of a lot of technology. We mentioned the wall of sound, of course, and certain amplifiers, but they also were early adopters of the fan mailing list. Way before anyone heard of Twitter or before there was a social media, they would set up tables at their shows and have fans fill out postcards, and they would build this mailing list, kind of a primitive database, right there at their shows. And then they started sending out a newsletter. So you talk to the Deadheads who would subscribe, and they would tell you about getting these newsletters periodically in the mail, maybe a couple of pages long, written in the actual voice of the Grateful Dead. There was nobody doing anything like that. Again, these were before social media. They were kind of early tweets. And I don't know if it was kind of a calculated effort to become more popular or whether this was just sort of who they were. We are talking about the Grateful Dead, sort of post-Jerry Garcia, after 1995. What happened to the core four? Fare thee well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. And we will continue our conversation with co-author Jerry Selvin, longtime music critic with the San Francisco Chronicle. And I will also open up the phone lines and take your calls. More of my conversation with Joel Selvin. Fare thee well, the Grateful Dead, when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Welcome back. We are here with Joel Selvin, co-author, Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. Before we get back into it, just a note. This just came across my email, and someone pointed this out, that co-founder of Jefferson Airplane, Marty Balin, dead today at the age of 76. Joel, your thoughts? Because I know, obviously, Marty and an altercation at Altamont involving Marty really kind of turned that whole situation very ugly.
Yeah, that's true. Marty was a key figure in the whole Altamont drama. He's also on the back jacket of Fare Thee Well. He was he read the book. He loved it. You know, I don't know what to say about this. I heard the news this afternoon, and it just, you know, it's heartbreaking. He'd gotten so screwed up with some post-operative problems at a hospital, and there's a medical malpractice suit, and it just ruined him. You don't know what to say about that. But Marty was the charter member of the San Francisco music scene. I mean, the Jefferson Airplane was his idea, and he was the driving force behind putting that band together and getting them on stage and making them into what they were.
And Altamont was really, it was sort of the Grateful Dead and Airplane's idea, and then the Stones kind of came in later, didn't they?
The Stones sort of tasked the Grateful Dead with putting that concert together. The Grateful Dead manager, Rock Scully, had been ran into Keith Richards in London, and they sort of dreamed it up. And the Stones thought the Grateful Dead, you know, they're famous for their free concerts. They know how to do this sort of stuff. But of course, in the long run, they couldn't let the Grateful Dead do it. They had to like step in and take control. And it didn't work out in the long run, as we all know.
It ended horribly.
It didn't end well.
Did Jerry Garcia ever, I mean, I don't want to belabor this point, but the Grateful Dead, I mean, they were so fearful of what was going on. I mean, they didn't even perform that day. Did Jerry Garcia ever talk to you about regrets about Altamont?
So Altamont was a traumatic episode for the Dead. It really changed how they saw the world. It was the end of innocence for them, for sure. And you were talking about their mailing list. All that was a reaction to Altamont, because after getting mixed up with the Stones, they decided to keep with their own. They decided to develop their own market, do their own thing, their own way. And they got out of their record company deal and started their own record company. They had their own booking agency. Like I said, they built up to 300 employees. They did everything themselves. And it was a real conscious reaction to the trauma of Altamont. You know what else was a conscious reaction to the trauma of Altamont? Working Man's Dead. Altamont was in December, and in January, they were all arrested down in New Orleans on drug charges. That was very catastrophic because Owsley was nabbed in the bust, and he was out on bail on other charges. So, boom, he went to prison and stayed there until his court case came up. And then in February, they went into the studio and recorded Working Man's Dead in 5 or 6 days.
5 or 6 days, monumental album. Post Jerry Garcia and post 95, when things were sort of at their ugliest, and I hate to keep bringing up Phil Lesh, and you know, you mentioned he's sort of the Macbeth, and his wife was Lady Macbeth, but there was a kind of when it was at its most antagonistic, there was a moment when Phil Lesh's band, he was sort of forcing Deadhead fans to choose between him and Bob Weir. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, there was a New Year's Eve battle. And the other ones got back together without Phil, but with Kreutzmann in, I'm thinking, 2000, the year 2000. And they had a very successful tour, and they were enjoying life. They were thinking about a New Year's Eve gig, and they checked out to see what Phil was doing, because at that point his Phil and Friends thing was quite an attraction. And they were given to understand that Phil would be in Florida for the holiday. So they went ahead and booked a big 16,000-seat arena in Oakland. And about 2 weeks later, Phil announced that Phil and Friends would be playing at an 8,000-seat arena in Oakland. And it's almost unfair because the Kaiser Auditorium where Lesh was going back to was like old home grounds for the Dead. It was where the band played all in the late 70s and early 80s before they really blew up. And that was the beginning of the great parking lot scenes with Henry Kaiser Auditorium. So Phil sold out his New Year's Eve show, and the other ones played to about half a house.
At a certain point when they were sort of together, didn't Lesh have the idea that they should carry on without the drummers? In other words, without Hart and Kreutzmann?
Well, that was the end of the 09 Dead tour, when he just had it with those guys. there was a constant battle over volume and tempo in the band. And the drummers were at the seat of the volume issue. So that was something. And then there were some personal things that didn't go well. So at the end of that 09 tour, Phil suggested to Bobby that they go out without the drummers. And that was the beginning of Further, which I think he called the ultimate Grateful Dead tribute band.
You mentioned that maybe the fatal mistake that they, not fatal, but the big mistake that they made after Jerry's death was to change the name of the band. Why?
Well, that's sort of, you know, my take on it. Name the Grateful Dead is just a valuable business asset, and to crumple it up and throw it in the trash can in a moment of grief 4 months after the event, it just doesn't strike me as the most sound thinking. And you know, I understand the sentiment behind it, and it makes sense. There is no Grateful Dead without Jerry Garcia. That's a fact of life. And in fact, all the way through their post-Jerry careers, that they've avoided using that name. They used the Dead for a while. The Farewell shows, I think, were advertised as the music of the Grateful Dead. But yeah, I mean, no, that was precipitous. They didn't need to do that. And not that there wasn't anything that they could have done with the name later, but it just, you know, like, why do that?
Despite all the acrimony, I mean, it was just nasty. But how did they finally get together in 2015 to celebrate the 50th anniversary and perform for those amazing concerts in Chicago and Santa Clara?
Those concerts blew everybody's mind, including the bands. They weren't entirely sure they could sell three Soldier Fields, and they were bowled over by the massive outpouring of interest in those concerts. I think that it's a tribute to their regard for the deadheads. I mean, we were talking about that earlier, and I was saying, they didn't want to hang out with them. But on the other hand, they did those concerts because they were expected to. They did those concerts because they knew the deadheads saw that as something that they had to do. They didn't want to. The three of them, Kreutzmann, Hart, and Weir, had some meetings with their managers and stuff like November the year before to talk about it. But there was no real, they weren't speaking to Phil at that point. And so it was up to Peter Shapiro, the jam band entrepreneur extraordinaire out of New York, who had signed a big money deal with Phil Lesh for exclusive concert rights. And he was in a position to kind of approach Phil in more informally. And he served as the bridge of communication. Those guys never really spoke again until they actually got together and rehearsed.
It's like negotiating a lasting Mideast peace.
It had that moment. I know it's in the book, and he described it so vividly to us. Mickey Hart going to rehearsal that first day and walking in and seeing there's nobody else there except Phil Lesh.
Hmm.
And that was a tense moment.
I'll say, but it came together. And how are they now after the concerts? I mean, was it awkward? Was it tense even then, or were they sort of swept away by the bonhomie and everything? And how are they now together?
Well, three of them, Weir, Hart, and Kreutzmann, are operating as Dead & Company with guitarist John Mayer, and drawing huge crowds, playing great music and having a wonderful time. Lesh has continued to go do his New York gigs with Peter Shapiro and his Marin County gigs at his club, the Terrapin Crossroads, mostly with his son's band, Graham Lesh. He's found time to do a two-man tour with Bobby Weir. They did a handful of dates last year, I think. Phil and Bobby were getting along for a while, but I don't think they are anymore. I don't know. It's like brothers that fight. They're bonded. They're wedded. They will be at each other's funerals and all that. And then they don't speak, and they, you know, it's like a family feud.
In many ways, it's silly, isn't it? Because it's music. It's intended to bring people together, and yet the people that are producing the music are really the antithesis of all that.
Well, yeah. I mean,
did you ever get fed up with them thinking, come on, guys, this is ridiculous?
I understood the whole drama. That's what interested me about writing this book. I saw it right away when I saw that they really didn't know what to do with themselves and had no clue about how the music business worked or what their assets really were. I mean, money fell out of the sky on them after Jerry died. If that hadn't happened, I don't know what these guys would have ended up doing. But the Dick's Picks, the CDs that were taken out of the archives that the Dead were selling out of their own office with no middleman, was after Jerry's death, they went into the stratosphere and started dumping like $50 million a year on the company for number of years, so they were able to like afford to not know what they're doing.
Is it the last chapter? Or is it possible that, I mean, Phil Lesh is approaching 80 now. I mean, at a certain point, you know, there's a point of no return, but will we see them get together again one more time, or is that it?
I wouldn't be at all surprised. Anything's possible, of course. Whatever they do in the future, even if all four of them play together, the whole Fare Thee Well concerts were epic, monumental events that will overshadow anything that happens in the future. They pulled the plug on the machines as they walked out of the door in Chicago, and what stayed behind is a remarkable vital, robust clan, a congregation of jam band fans who are turning their attention all over the place, and it seems 1,000 bands have sprung up where there was, you know, so few before. It's just amazing.
And sort of the children of the Grateful Dead, we think of bands like Phish. I mean, are there more? Do you expect to see sort of this phenomena again, where a band, you know, they don't necessarily get the commercial recognition or the airplay, but they have this massive cult following that they become an industry among, you know, unto themselves. Is that going to ever replicate?
Well, this is such a different world with the internet and the streaming and MP3s, all that. It really, you know, the Grateful Dead were a one-off event that took place because of a whole combustion of times and places and personalities. No, that's not going to happen again. Will there be musicians making music that people appreciate outside the channels of mainstream media? Yeah, that goes on all the time. That's going on right now. Think of like the whole acoustic music world, you know, the folk music guys. I mean, they live out there. There's festivals, there's nightclubs. You never hear the music. You don't even know who we're talking about that's working at those clubs. But there's a whole acoustic music scene.
Do you miss those days?
Which days?
Well, I guess the sort of the heyday of classic rock, you know, 65 to 75.
Oh, man, you should have been there. Oh,
Are you good to take some calls?
Let's talk after the break.
Absolutely, we'll do that. Fare thee well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. Just Pamela Turley's not with us. Tell us a little bit of about Pamela.
Pamela is from Atlanta, and she brings a very important perspective to this project. When I retired from the Chronicle in 2009, I stopped going to these post-Jerry Garcia Grateful Dead shows because I no longer had to. And my memories of the Grateful Dead are vivid, okay? So Pamela never saw the Grateful Dead. She first walked into the scene in 2005 at a Rat Dog show. I think she's seen 150 shows by Phil and Friends, Further, Rat Dog, and all these bands. So she had the picture of that much more vividly than I did.
Fascinating. All right. We will open up the phone lines. Just a reminder, coming up at the top of the hour, open lines. But right now, we'll take your questions and comments. For Joel Selvin, author of Fare Thee Well, here's one more shot from the Grateful Dead, taking us into the break with Cumberland Blues here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We are talking about the Grateful Dead post-Jerry Garcia, but if you go back to the early years, it was perhaps Ron Pigpen McKernan, the keyboard player, who was steeped in blues and rhythm and blues, who was really the anchor for the band. In fact, he was so central, so much a core of the band, that when he passed away in 1973, Jerry Garcia said, "We're not the Dead anymore." But of course they were. For many more years, and they keep going. Perhaps they have written their final chapter, perhaps not, but it's all documented in Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. Joel Selvin stays with us for a few moments yet. We'll take your questions and comments when we come back. Coast to Coast AM is coming to you live from Coast Toronto affiliate, In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Stay with us. Well, I think it's appropriate as we go to the phones that we start with the great state of Kentucky, of course, the home state of Owsley Stanley. Steve is on the wild card line. Hey, Steve, you're on the line with Joel Selvin.
Hey, good morning, Richard. Good morning, Joel. Joel, I wanted to ask you, I'm doing some research on one of the Midwest's largest marijuana networks of the 80s. And according to the newsletters of the Grateful Dead, they got involved in the 420 movement around early 90s. And I wonder what your thoughts were about that and what timeline that was, because this group actually started the 420 movement, say, mid-80s, 86. And the reason why they didn't say anything is because obviously they're they're involved in illegal activities. And I just wonder what your thoughts were on that, and how the Grateful Dead became the flow of the 420 movement in the 90s.
It's news to me. I'm not surprised that they had a lot of interest in activist movements and their philanthropy spanned diverse sort of things. Like Phil Lesh was very interested in modern classical composers who aren't very well supported by grants and the Rex Foundation, the Dead's philanthropic arm. It's one of the biggest supporters of modern classical music for a number of years. And then they bought the Lithuanian Olympic basketball team, their uniforms. But I'm not surprised to hear that they're back in legal marijuana. They were all enthusiastic endorsers of the product.
No doubt. Steve, thank you for that. Let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Roy, welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you, Joel and Richard. Okay, I brag about this to this day. Early 70s, I think 74, after Pigpen died, they replaced him with Nicky Hopkins on keyboard. And I saw them, the Dead, at Duke University, small venue. And I was nuts about the whole West Coast scene, Quicksilver, Hot Tuna. And I loved Phil Lesh, didn't really know Nicky Hopkins. I love Phil Lesh's songs, Box of Rain, Jack Straw, Unbroken Chain. They seem more unique and just complicated. Well, anyway, during the concert, Nicky Hopkins, maybe the greatest keyboard player of all time, I noticed, I was the only one noticed among my friends, that it seemed like Lesh and Hopkins were just playing for them, were playing the lead, and everybody else just followed along. And it was a four-hour concert. And I wonder if there was there any friction? You talked about Phil Lesh last half hour. Was there any friction with Nicky Hopkins coming in with the other members and Phil Lesh kind of?
I got to tell you, I don't think Nicky ever played with the Dead. He was in Jerry's band for a while.
It was Keith Godshow that replaced Ron McKernan, wasn't it?
Keith Godshow was the guy you saw in 74, yeah. I remember seeing Nicky.
It was Nicky Hopkins.
It was sort of the low point of Nicky's career, but they were fun. I mean, Nicky came to San Francisco and joined Quicksilver Messenger Service. And then they sat around for 9 months and didn't do anything.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's say hi to, first-time caller line, Bob is in, is it Peoria, Illinois? Bob?
Bobby Fish. I'm calling from Peoria land, Peoria, Illinois. Listening to you on 100.3 FM.
Welcome.
WMBD. And my question is, Richard, great show, great fill-in. You're from Toronto? Great. Mr. Salvin, great. This is an awesome show. And not only that, I'm a first-time caller line on to Coast AM.
Welcome aboard. Thank you.
Since I've been listening to it for years. Now, I had a couple questions. First of all, I heard that Vince Welnick, who was the last keyboard player when Jerry was still alive, he used to play with the Tubes, correct?
Yep.
Did he commit suicide?
He did indeed.
He did indeed.
Jerry's death not only ended the Grateful Dead, but it also put Vince sort of on the outside of everything. You know, he'd only been in the band a couple few years, and it was very, very depressing to Vince. I mean, he really there was a kind of pathetic suicide attempt on the Rat Dog bus, and that was his last sort of event as a member of any of the official Grateful Dead bands. And then he kept trying to, you know, get back into their good graces, and it just never worked. And in the long run, yeah, you know, the depression overcame him. And by the way, the Tubes, you mentioned the Tubes. I loved the Tubes. They were one of the best bands in the world at the time, and the only people who knew it lived in San Francisco.
Comment, if I may. There are several songs that Jerry played on. One of them is what, Lakeshore Drive, Teach Your Children Well, and Bobby and the Grateful Dead influence here in Peoria, Illinois, was just massive. The influence that my first Grateful Dead show gave to me influenced me. I went out and learned how to drive a truck and then a tractor trailer. And after I learned how to do that, somehow or another, I was out in California and I was talking to Rob Halford on a phone call like this on a radio show. And he told me to go learn how to mix stage monitors. And so, man, I got into the show business thing. And after Jerry died, I was a stagehand union guy here in Peoria, and Disney on Ice come through town, and I wound up going out on tour with them, and I went up and down the East, built the tour, and took it up and down the East Coast, and every venue we played, I would go into that venue, and I would have board tapes. And when we would set up the PA, we'd jam out some shows from Hampton Coliseum or Madison Square Garden or Rosemont Horizon. And I tell you what, the influence the Grateful Dead had on the stagehand world is awesome.
That's an excellent point. Bob in Peoria Land, Illinois. Thank you for that. Let's say hi to Keith in Rochester, New York. Good morning, Keith. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yes, sir. Right here, I'm holding Mr. Selvin's book, Altamont. The actual date of that concert was this Saturday, the 6th of December of 1969, if anyone's wondering. I would encourage everyone to get this book. It's very well written and fast-paced. And I have three fast questions, of which will include the Dead. First off, you mentioned a Pamela. In this book, there's a Miss Pamela who started out with Jimmy Page and then ended up somewhat with Mick Jagger. She was very beautiful, and I was wondering politely whatever happened to Miss Pamela.
Miss Pamela is out there in the world on Facebook, and she sells vintage clothing on eBay, and she's still a beautiful woman.
I want to ask about Mickey Hart's father, Lenny, who became the group's business manager and from day one was stealing from the group and definitely absconded with a lot of money. You earlier mentioned a large amount of money, $50 million, but in this book, politely, you make clear that the Grateful Dead's finances were always precarious, and was wondering how that worked. They were always, they were not a commercial band, and their finances were always on the edge. I'm just trying to tie the two together, and then I have a third question.
Lenny stole a lot of money in terms of the Grateful Dead. It was pretty much all the money they had, but I think that the amount was about $80,000, which is not a lot of money when you think about, like, stealing an entire company's net worth. Yeah, he disappeared, and the money disappeared, and they hired a private detective to find him. They found him. He was arrested. He went to jail. He came out of jail. He died, and Mickey went to his funeral to spit on his coffin.
Oh, my. Wow. Wow. All right, Keith, one more quick one.
The best drummer ever. I go back, and I remember drummers like Gene Krupa, and other drummers, and going back that far, and was wondering who you think in terms of who the all-time greatest drummer.
Geez, there's so many, you know. I mean, like, just a bunch just popped in my head. Would it be Hal Blaine? Would it be Jim Keltner? Would it be Prairie Prince of the Tubes? That's probably why his name popped in, but he is up there, I'm telling you. It might be somebody we haven't heard. geez, the greatest drummer, you know. One of my favorites was the Tom Ardolino, who played for the NRBQ. He had a real unique signature style. A lot of the great Burt Bacharach records were played by a guy named Gary Chester. He's unsung hero of recording sessions in New York. God, I don't know, man. It's hard to say. I mean, other people probably think about Keith Moon or John Bonham or something like that. But you know, I'm more along the Jim Keltner lines.
Keith, and, hey, thank Keith, you for that.
Thanks for the
oh, sorry.
Words
go ahead.
About Altamont. I appreciate that.
Keith, thank you. You know, if they had not gotten together in 2015 for these great concerts, your story would have ended on a tale of litany and woe with no happy ending. Would anybody have...
You'd say that, because I first put this book together as a proposal in 2006. And the thing that spurred me was there was this convergence of events. One was the death of Ramrod, their longtime roadie, who was really as crucial to their scene as Jerry was. And like 2 days later, really, the moving van shows up and pulls the tape library out and sends it down to Burbank, where Warner Brothers is going to take over the band's greatest asset. And all four guys weren't even speaking to each other at that point. And I thought, man, you know, the door just slammed shut. That's the end of that whole thing. And I put together this book proposal. And all the publishers just thought it was ridiculous, because it's just a book that's just a downward spiral, and all it goes is all the way down. And then one guy said, this would be a good book for people that don't like the Dead. And then after Fare Thee Well, I ran into Mickey Hart like a week or so afterwards, and he was just whole and complete and well in ways I hadn't seen him in years. And I realized, oh, there's my happy ending. And that's where Pamela comes in. I was in the middle of writing Altamont, and I tasked Pamela with revising my old proposal.
And had it not been for the reunion, you wouldn't have had your happy ending.
There was no happy ending until then. And really, there was, you know, you can go back like 6 months before the reunion, and they still weren't ready for a happy ending.
Brian is in Colorado. Brian on the wildcard line. Welcome to Coast AM.
Richard and Coast AM personnel, thank you very much for taking my call. Joel, thanks for writing the book. Bringing back these memories is great. I lived in San Francisco in 69 and 70, and I'm blessed to say I got to see the Dead a lot. I've got a story that I read maybe in Rolling Stone. I'm not sure where I read it. And I left the city in late 1970, so this definitely happened after that. It was before the first European tour, and Joel probably knows when that was or close, but anyway, it was after I was gone. And Joel mentioned that at one point there were like 300 employees, and it was a big family, and it was kind of that way, not to that extent maybe, but in 69 and 70. So anyway, before the tour, they're going on a European tour, and everybody is psyched, and all the people, you know, everybody. The person who's taking care of the mailing list of all the fans and people that do whatever, all these different people that hangers on is not really a good word. It was a family, and they're a large family. And so they're all wondering, well, do some of us go? Do half of us go? Do all of us go? And everybody's wondering, and everybody wants to go for sure. I know if I'd been that kind of a person, I would have wanted to go, and I think most people would agree with that. And so it's all kind of up in the air. And then finally, Jerry says, everybody goes. And to me, that's a class act, and I think more people ought to be aware of that, so that's why I called in. And Pigpen and Joel, the Tubes, I thought they were a great band. I agree with you on that. So you guys, thanks a lot.
Hi,
thank
man.
You. Thank you, Brian. What do you think of the latest incarnation, Dead & Company, the addition of John Mayall? Are you a fan? Has that tainted the legacy? What are your thoughts?
So, like I said earlier, I really have too vivid a recall on what Grateful Dead sounded like when Jerry was in the band. And all these post-Jerry things have been interesting to me, but it's just some other people playing the repertoire. Now, the Dead & Company, of all the versions of this thing I've seen after Jerry died, that one's the most interesting and satisfying to me. I'm not sure why. John Mayer is a much better guitarist than you would imagine, and he really doesn't sound like Jerry, but he kind of fits right in the same place. And the other guys are playing real great, and they love the bass player, Oteil. He comes down on the one, you know. So that band's got some pizzazz, you know. It made me feel good in ways that the Rat Dog never did. But really, you know, I there are people that want to hear this repertoire, and especially performed by people that had been in the Grateful Dead. I don't know how many shows I saw of the Grateful Dead, but I saw them at least every year for 30 years. And this is like a pale imitation.
What are you working on now, Joel?
Well, I just finished writing a documentary movie about Chicago blues. I've got some, projects in the works, and always looking for new ideas and good stories.
Well, you are one of the great treasures in this field, one of the great chroniclers of classic rock, and because of you and your magnificent storytelling, we can all relive these years. Thank you so much, Joel. It's always a delight spending time with you.
Great to be on Coast to Coast. I love the show, Richard, and you're terrific. Thanks a lot.
All right, all the best. Joel Selvin, co-author of Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of The Grateful Dead's Long Strange Trip, and what a long strange trip it has been. Well, we can go further and continue this long strange trip. We will open up the phone lines, open lines for the next 2 hours. And here's what we could do. Why don't you share with me? We'll keep it in the rock and roll vein, if you want, just a suggestion. But perhaps you want to share one of the great rock moments in your life, maybe a brush with greatness. Maybe you ran across John Lennon coming out of the Fillmore East or somewhere in Los Angeles. Maybe it's more of a paranormal kind of a feel. Maybe you ran into Jim Morrison's ghost at a burrito shop in Venice Beach. You tell me. Here is Touch of Grey, The Grateful Dead, taking us into the break just before Open Lines and Coast to Coast AM.